is Dolores Cannon again with the Metaphysical Hour. And we're going to be talking again tonight with another special guest. But before we get started, let me give out the toll-free number in case anybody does want to call in. The number is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. And that number is good all over the world. But everybody always says they'd rather just listen instead of call in. So we'll see what happens anyway. Got a little bit of irritated throat tonight, so I'm hoping I'm not going to start coughing. Okay, my guest tonight is Bob Brown. And you know, as I've told you before, I like to have people on that I've known a long time. That makes it a whole lot easier. Bob Brown is the one that puts on the International UFO Conference in Laughlin, Nevada. Bob and his wife, Terry, have been doing this for many years. And that's going to be coming up in another week. Are you there, Bob?
I'm sure here, Dolores. Awfully good to hear your voice tonight.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, though, that you have to make the call from the hospital.
Well, thank you.
Is Terry okay?
Well, she is, you know, fighting the battle. Yes, she is okay. But she's a sick little girl right now, and, you know, we just have to keep saying prayers and look for a little help from upstairs, and hopefully everything is going to work out okay.
And I think everybody out there who knows both of you will be putting their energy toward her, too. You know?
Well,
but,
thank you. Thank you.
You're in Colorado, though, aren't you?
Yes, we are.
So you won't be going to Nevada for another week, then, will you?
No, I well, actually, normally I end up usually driving the truck in that has all of the Congress's audiovisual stuff and everything that all the staging stuff and that we use to set the event up. I usually drive that in, and I normally have to leave several days early to do that. But because of the situation this year, we've gotten a couple of volunteers that are going to do the driving so that I can just basically leave the day before we begin.
Oh.
And I'll get in there almost on a leisurely schedule this year.
Uh-huh. Well, that's it. You don't want to leave Terry alone for too long, do you?
That's it. Yeah, that's it completely. Yeah.
Well, I know your daughters have also been helping you for many years.
Well, they have, and this year both of my two oldest girls have stepped in and have taken over and done most of Terry's job for the last couple of months, and they've just done a wonderful thing, and it's
always been kind of a family event that way.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, but that's true, Dolores. And if they wouldn't have been willing to step in and take over for her, we'd be hard pressed to have a conference next week.
Well, this is a big conference. It's what I've heard. It's the biggest UFO conference in the United States.
Well, it's actually the biggest one, I believe, in the world.
Oh.
There may be a couple that have got more attendance, but not more man days of learning. When you think about the fact that our event goes on for 7 nights and it goes on from early morning through very late night,
yeah.
It's like an intensive graduate course. If you look at the man hours of learning that's involved in this week-long event, there isn't anything in the world that touches it as far as the number of educational hours that people are receiving.
Yeah, because I know I've spoken at UFO conferences in different parts of the world. I think you're right. They only just for like a weekend or something.
Yeah. 2 days is typical.
Yeah, especially the Crop Circle Conference in Glastonbury. That just goes on for a few days and
stuff like that,
you know.
Yep. Well, we found out, you know, we do this event for 7 nights and 7 days because something truly magical happens when you can join like-minded people for a full week, intensive week, I would say, of discovery and learning and camaraderie. It's magical, and it's life-changing. I don't say that lightly, but the simple truth is, for anybody that has never been there, believe me, I say it from my heart, it is life-changing.
Well, I think a lot of people like to be, like you said, with like-minded people. There's a lot of these things they can't just talk to about anybody, with anyone. They have to have someone who understands.
Especially when you're getting into the realm of the experiencers and people that have, you know, have had a very intimate contact with something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. There's not very many places that these people can go to get any sense of anybody being able to begin to have an inkling of what they're going through.
Yeah, I know, because, you know, I'm still doing the investigations, and I still get people that come, and they'll say, I can't talk about this to anybody, you know, when they come to my office. And they'll say, I'm afraid to even tell you. You're probably going to think I'm crazy. And
yes.
I said, I've heard it all, you know. So then they start telling their story, and they said, you mean this isn't freaking you out?
Yeah.
I said, no, not me, anyway. But they can't just talk to just anyone.
No, they can't.
That makes a big difference.
Yeah, at least not in the beginning. Once a person gets to the point where they can handle what's going on with them, once they can come to an understanding and an acceptance of it on some level, then some of them get to the point where they can begin to talk about it openly.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's a handful that go on to the point where they're actually able to share their stories with others in a very in-depth way.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's another level again, but many people do end up reaching it. Thank goodness. Otherwise, we'd be in the dark a lot more than we are about what's going on.
Well, I know I've found in my work a lot of times when they're all by themselves, they don't understand the experience, and it takes on the wrong meaning, but that's not the right word. But, you know, they blow it out of proportion. If they have somebody else to talk to who has been there, done that, and like I've been investigating this for 20 years, you can put it more into proportion, and it doesn't disturb their life as well, as much that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. And, of course, I mean, you know, during the event, Dolores, as you know, we have actually four sessions during the week,
mm-hmm.
that are, they're like group sessions, I guess you could fairly call them.
Yeah.
And we have a very experienced person that leads these sessions, therapist and hypnotherapist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've done it in the past.
Yes,
Barbara Land.
Of course you have. Yes, indeed. And so this is, you know, absolutely free to the public to attend these sessions. You don't even have to register or pay a dime if you just feel the need to come in and try to figure out what's going on with you. This is something that's there for you.
And there's no press allowed. I know they close the doors, so
yep.
It's very private when
yeah,
they're doing this.
Yeah, it's completely a private thing, and it's immensely helpful for so many people. I just can't begin to tell you. And it's just, you know, something that is part of the week-long event. And then later in the week, if, you know, there's usually always, out of any group that gathers, there's usually always a handful of people that are to the point where it begins to be therapeutically good for them to talk about what's happened with their own situation. And we do have one session during the conference. Again, though, even this public session, it's still, you know, the attendees are in.
That's the one you do before the whole group.
Yeah, we do it before the whole group, but that's strictly on a volunteer basis for those people that are at a point in dealing with
uh-huh.
their contact that it becomes therapeutically valuable for them to share it with a like-minded audience.
Yeah, I've helped with that one also, where they would call them up on the stage and they could tell everyone about it.
Yes.
They have to be very brave to do that, because a lot of them have been holding this inside for many, many years.
They have been. But as you know, psychologically, if they can get over that barrier, then when they go home, they're in a whole lot better place.
Yeah, that's what therapy is all about, really.
Yes.
But I was trying to think, I think the first conference I did with you was back about 1999 or somewhere in there. It was toward the end of the 90s.
So yeah, it was in the late 90s. I can't be for sure. I think it might have been even 97. I'm not absolutely sure. I think this will be your seventh. For sure your sixth.
Yeah, I know I've done it a long time with you, and so we do go back a long ways.
Yeah, we do.
But I want to go back to your beginnings in this.
Okay.
Now, you know, they said this is the 32nd one, but
that's... No, no, 16th.
Okay, I saw something. Oh, I know what I was saying. There's another conference I'm going to, 16.
Right.
But you were counting the ones you were doing in the summer in that number?
No, no, this is just the winter.
The winter.
Actually, you know, if we count the precedent event before the International UFO Congress became an official organization,
yeah,
itself, if we count the founding event, which was was an event called the International UFO Congress, and now we are the International UFO Congress Convention and Film Festival. But
uh-huh.
If you go back to that founding one, this is actually the 17th year.
In the 17th year, because, you know, I've been involved with the one UFO conference in Eureka Springs since its beginning.
Yes.
And we are, I think it's 18 or 19.
Yeah, I think Lou started up, I think, a year ahead of us, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
And I think we're maybe, I know we have about 400 people, where you usually get about 800.
Correct.
So we're both staying in there anyway.
Yes.
There is still an interest. But that's why I want to go back to the beginnings then, is, you know, how you got started in this. What got you interested in the first place?
Doris, I'm going to do my very best to answer this for you, very straightforwardly.
I like to background on people.
I have to go back to my very young years. I'm talking about when I was 5 years old, 6 years old.
Okay.
And I can't remember, you know, a whole lot of detail from those years, but I do know one thing. I have always felt, as far back as I can remember thinking about anything, that there's no possible way we could be alone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a strange thought, I will grant you, for a six-year-old to have.
Yeah.
But that's something that has always been in my consciousness. I cannot remember when it wasn't. Now, that being said, as I grew up, as I went through my formative years and then into my teens, I always had an interest in the UFO phenomena. You know, what did people really know about this possibility of us not really being alone in the universe? And so I was always interested in that subject. But it wasn't limited to just UFOs. Actually, I was always interested, too, in all of the, shall we say, esoteric or paranormal realms of inquiry.
Because I was thinking way back when you were about 5 or 6, there wasn't a whole lot out about UFOs at that time, was there?
No, there really was not. But I can remember even when I was like, you know, 9 and 10 and stuff like that, I would have my dad go and buy magazines like Saga. And Saga was, back in the very early 50s, a magazine like that was considered a men's magazine.
Yeah.
You know, it had a few scantily clad young ladies in it, but it was also about the only place that you could find the occasional story or article being written about someone that had an encounter with a saucer, or, you know, a pilot or an observer or a military person or something like this. There just weren't very many places where this information was published or available. So when I would see it, I would gather it up anywhere that I could. I was just kind of voracious about it. But at the same time, I was growing up, and, you know, there was school and
everything else.
And everything else. So it wasn't obsessive.
I was back in the early days of Fate magazine.
Well, yes, of course.
And I've had Phyllis Galdi on this show, too, because I had magazines going back, some of the first issues, and I've saved them all those years, and I, just a few months ago, I gave her my entire collection, because she said a lot of the old ones were destroyed by, in the water.
Yes.
So
yes.
A lot of them are just don't exist anymore.
Yes. Yeah, that was very nice of you to give them.
That was even a very unusual magazine back in those days.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So I know what you mean. There wasn't very much around that covered this kind of thing.
No, there really and truly wasn't. But, be that as it may, my interest, waned and peaked and waned and peaked. And it kind of got re-stimulated, I guess, when I was about 1965-ish, 66-ish. Can't remember exactly. But
yeah.
At that time, a girlfriend and I, we flew a small plane down to Baja, California, on the Pacific side, to Scammon's Lagoon. And we were going down there to watch the gray whales. That's where they would go to mate and have their young in Scammon's Lagoon. It's about halfway down Baja on the Pacific side. And we landed there fairly late in the day and reconnoitered and picked out our spots for sighting, for whale watching the next morning and all. And then a big Pacific fog bank started rolling in. It got very cold. We set the tent up quickly and went in. We even cooked inside the tent. That's how cold it got,
mm-hmm.
With the fog bank rolling in. And so we were in the tent for a few hours, and then she went outside. And the next thing I knew, she was hollering at me, screaming at me, actually, "Bob, get the hell out here. What is this? What is this helicopter doing over us? Bob, get out here. What?" And she's just shouting this. And so I'm scurrying around, trying to get something on my feet. And I get some shoes back on, and I run outside the tent. And I look up, and I'm expecting to see a helicopter because this is what she's been, shouting at me. And I look up, and the first thought that was in my mind was that these are the brightest recognition lights I've ever seen. All aircraft have a red and green light on either side, so you can tell if the aircraft's coming or going.
Yeah.
You see it in the sky. And so I'm looking up, and that's the first thought that forms in my mind, but no sooner does it form than I know it's absolutely wrong, because I'm not looking at anything that's got a red and green light on either side. I'm looking at something that is absolutely pulsing, red to green, like a live plasma pulsing, just literally right over our heads. And you're old enough maybe to remember this. A lot of people I talk to aren't. But if you remember back in the 50s, there was a little craze that went along with aluminum Christmas trees. And you'd buy these aluminum Christmas trees, and you'd have a color wheel, a wheel that had gels of color that turned.
Oh yeah, but sit on the floor.
Over light, sit
on the
floor. So the Christmas tree is, it's just pure aluminum, but yet when you watch it, it looks like the whole tree is changing colors. It would go from yellow to blue to green to red. It would go through those colors, and it would just, the tree would just change colors. Well, it wasn't the same at all, because this thing was like a live pulsing plasma, like a heart beating almost.
Oh.
And the thing was just, changing literally red to green to red to green. And as I'm watching it, it's shrinking, just literally shrinking in front of my eyes as I'm watching it. It's just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But it's remaining virtually at zenith right above our heads and just going straight up and straight out. So I ran.
Thinking by going smaller, do you think it was moving away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely it was moving away. It was going up and out. And so I ran back in the tent, and I got my binoculars, and I ran back out. We were flying in a low-wing airplane, a Mooney. And so I balanced the binoculars on the wing and was down on the ground with my knees to get really steady. And I'm continuing to watch it. And after I ran back out, maybe for another, it wasn't long, 10, 15 seconds, I could still see a little bit of color in the pulsing of the light. And then I could only see like a white pulsing, just like a white strobing in the light. Couldn't see color. I looked in the binocular. I could still see color for a few more seconds. And then in the binocular, even, it just got just a faint little white dot of pulse, and then just a faint dot of light, and then just basically it was gone. So whatever it was,
back into a white light.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the naked eye, first it just went back to white. I couldn't see color anymore, and then.
Yeah.
In the binocular, I could still discern color for a few seconds.
A little bit, then.
And then it went to white, too.
A plane wouldn't do that.
Oh, no, my God, no, not at all. And so, that kind of woke me back up. That got my attention. I kind of renewed my interest in things at that point. So, life went on, and I began going to more of the conventions that they had at the time. I joined APRO, I joined NICAP, so I got their newsletters that came in, and I subscribed, continued to, you know, read everything I could in the way of books. By that point, of course, you know, a number of books had been published, and a number of books continued to be published. But then as time moved on, we come to a time about roughly 20 years ago, 21 years ago, and a guy, an old-time investigator, even back then he was an old-time, long-time investigator, Wendell Stevens, started talking to people here in the United States about a case that he was investigating in Switzerland, a one-armed farmer.
Yeah, Billy Meyer. I've had Wendell on the show. He's an old friend also.
Yeah, Billy Meyer, exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, Wendell, he's been around forever.
Yes, he has. He's probably the greatest treasure we have in ufology.
Oh, he's got, what is it, over 3,000 pictures of UFOs. The largest collection I think there is.
Largest collection in the world, Dolores. You're absolutely right.
And I think he was one of the first ones to investigate the Billy Meyer case.
He was, from the U.S., that's for certain.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he and Lee Elders were the first U.S. investigators to go over. But in any case, to boil this down for you, and all of this is by way of answering your question about how in the heck did I get involved in this.
I'd like to know about how people get into these strange things.
Trying to make a very long story short.
Yeah.
But, I got the NICAP newsletters, and I got the APRO newsletters, and amazingly, virtually one newsletter to the next newsletter, virtually at the same time they came out, and both of these newsletters absolutely basically said that this Billy Meyer case was the biggest fraud ever seen in ufology, and it was a bunch of bunk, and you know, don't believe a word of it.
Now, we've heard that before.
At that particular time, you know, I kind of thought that APRO and NICAP this goes back 20, 21 years. This is going back like 30, 31 years now.
Yeah.
Forgive me. I gotta make that correction. So I basically dismissed the Billy Meyer case.
Well, so you believe that it probably was a fake then?
Well, I thought at that time that both APRO and NICAP were organizations that were reporting nothing but the truth.
Yeah.
Now, I found out later, we have to move forward about 10 years, and now we're coming into the time frame of 20 or 21 years ago. It's about 10 years after the Billy Meyer case was first being told. Now, you know, look, it could be, you know, 11 years, but, I mean, I hope nobody wants to take me over the coals and, you know, hold my feet to the fire because I'm missing this a little bit.
Well, you know, it's hard to get the dates and everything. But
sometimes I have a hard time telling you what I did yesterday, let alone what happened 30 years ago.
I think you're coming up to the Ed Meyer case on Gulfreeze, then, aren't you?
We're getting into that era. We certainly are.
Yeah.
But anyway, this comes back to the Meyer case. I read this book called Light Years by Gary Kinder. And it was a book that took another look. It took a relook at the Meyer case. And after I read this book, by this point in my life, I was beginning to develop a little bit of innate discernment, and perhaps, can I say, guidance to some degree. I get a certain physiological reaction that happens, and when I think this is the real deal, there is something that happens, and I have grown to trust it. I don't expect anybody else to believe anything I say based on that, but in my, you know, for my own self, I'm learning to trust it more and more.
Yeah.
So I read this book and I said, you know what? I was hoodwinked. 10 years ago, when APRO and NICAP told me that this was a phony case, the reason for that turns out that both of these organizations were trying to survive. They mostly did it based on membership. They had very limited resource. Both of these organizations contacted Billy Meyer virtually at the same time. They both wanted to come over to investigate it.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said to Meyer, however, was, Each one of them said exactly the same thing. Well, we're ready to send our investigator over, or maybe we can send two investigators, but we'll come over, investigate the case. We want to meet you, and we want to see all the pictures you've taken. We want to investigate the sites and talk to the other witnesses, and we'll do the best we can to get to the bottom of this. But by the way, Mr. Meyer, you have to sign an exclusivity contract with us.
Uh-huh.
Because we cannot afford to spend our limited resource if we don't have the exclusive ability to talk about your case, you know, in the U.S.
Yeah.
And Meyer said to them, well, you know what, guys? This is a story for the world. I'll be happy to tell you about it, happy to share it with you. I'll give it to you freely. Don't want anything for it. But I'm going to give it freely and share it with anyone that wants it. No, I'm not going to give you an exclusive. So he wouldn't give APRO the exclusive. He wouldn't give NICAP the exclusive. So in their fear that the other organization would then, you know, perhaps accept the terms of non-exclusivity and perhaps scoop them on the case, they both simultaneously just decided to come out and to simply cut the case off at the knees so that if the other organization attempted to do anything with it, it would already be largely discredited.
You know, that's a lot of people, they always say, oh, these different cases have been proven to be fraud, but they don't really go into the background to find out more about it and find out what happened there.
No, they absolutely don't. So here we're coming down to the crux of it. So at this point in my life, I knew I'd been hoodwinked. And at that time, at this point in my life, I was making documentary films. Mostly aviation films, but I did distribute them in the U.S. and I did, buy and sell into other areas of the world for product that was made in the U.S. So I went to the Milan, the Cannes Film Festival, the MIPCOM, and that would be a 10-day festival, and then there was a week off, and then that was followed by the MIFED, the Milan Film Festival. So I would attend these film festivals every year. And this one was coming up in 3 months, and I'd read the book, and I said, gee, I've got a week off, I'm going to be in Europe, I can take that week, perhaps travel to Switzerland, perhaps find this village of Schmidt-Rudy, where Meyer is supposed to be, perhaps find his farm, check these sites out where these photos were taken, perhaps look for some of the witnesses, maybe I can even get to meet Meyer.
Taking it all on faith, maybe it would all fall together.
Maybe I can try to do this, right? So I am really hyped up about this. I cannot. Every waking moment on my mind is to get to the bottom of the truth of the Meyer case. So we're going to advance 3 months. I'm in Europe. I'm in Cannes, and the second day of that festival, they would have a big party down at the Palm Beach, and these giant double-decker buses that hold on like 140 people come along, and people stream out of the Palais, and they go in the buses, they take you to the other side of town, to the Palm Beach, and I'm there at the party, and I'm walking with a friend that I'm doing film business with in Germany, and we're walking from one pavilion building to the other pavilion building, and we're talking business, talking film stuff, and as I'm walking along, and again, this is a big, huge open terrace right on the Mediterranean, and from one pavilion building to the other, I'm going in a straight line, and it's crowded with people. There's 6,000 or more people at this party, and a woman is walking from right to left through the crowd as my friend and I are going at 90 degrees to her direction. And as she walks across my field of vision, working her way through the crowd, directly in front of me, a voice speaks in my head, Dolores. First and last time, only time this has ever happened. It was absolutely crystal clear, just as clear as you and I talking right now. And what it says was, you must talk to this woman. You must talk to this woman. And I'm walking away, and I'm walking with my friend, and we're going along, and my friend realizes that I'm not there right now, and he excuses himself, and the next thing I know, they've got bars set up all around this pavilion building. I'm in front of one of these little bars, and I'm drinking some sort of a liquor drink, and I'm sort of gulping it, and I'm just walking in circles, and I'm literally going crazy. I don't know what's happening.
Well, the logical part of your mind takes over, you know. And
well,
you talk to a stranger and stuff like that, you know.
So here's what I said. I said, okay, I'll talk to her. And it was like somebody hit a light switch. It stopped. It stopped. And I said in my mind, okay, I'll talk to her. Now I'm scared. I'm scared because I don't know what's happening. How am I going to find her? There's 6,000 people here, right? 6,000. How am I going to find her? So I retraced my steps. I said, okay, I think she passed me about here. She was going in this direction. I go in this direction. And I go down, and I'm coming up against the railing against the Mediterranean. And there's tables out at that point. But there she is. She's sitting there, and she's talking to two guys. Okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? Okay, let's say I got this. Got a drink in my hand. Okay, I walk up to her. I sort of get as close as I can to them, and I just act like I'm looking out over the Mediterranean. And I get close enough to try to hear what they're saying. And it turns out these two guys are talking about making their next film, and if they can get the funding, they're going to do a documentary on the 25th anniversary of the Concorde supersonic airliner. Oh, my God. Well, that's my business. I'm in aviation video.
Uh-huh.
It's what I do. So I look up and I say, wow, gee, many Christmas. Thank you, guys. What a way to hook me up with these guys. You know, we may never have met if it wasn't for you telling me to follow that woman.
Yeah.
So I turn around and we talk shop for 15 minutes, and they say, yeah, if we get the funding, we'll talk to you about distribution in the U.S. And, you know, you can't hope for more than that to open the door and to get a chance to put together a deal. And so then they're gone, and I'm left with this young lady. And so we just start talking shop, talking business. We go and we have a couple of wines, and we hang out for 45 minutes. And then we look at each other and say, well, you ready to go? Yeah, I'm ready to go. We walk back down, we get on the buses, and we're heading back in. Back to the Palais. So she's sitting next to the window, and I'm sitting next to the aisle, and we're talking. And I said, hey, by the way, I said, I'm premiering a new film here in 70 millimeter. It is it's a beautiful aviation film. And I said, come and see it. I'm showing it in 2 days in theater such and such at such and such a time. She says, oh, man, Bob, it just sounds like a great film. I'd love to come see it, but I'm only going to be here just tomorrow, because I got to leave early the next morning. I've got to meet my crew. I'm going to be doing a story on whether they're going to declare the African elephant an endangered species or not. And I got to go meet my crew in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Switzerland. What pops into my mind, Dolores? Billy Meyer, right?
Yeah.
So I say to this woman, never really expecting much more than a blank stare, I say to her, by Switzerland, that's interesting. I said, does the name Edward Billy Meyer mean anything to you? Dolores, she turned white as a sheet. She melted against the window. I mean, she literally melted against the window to get every molecule of her body as far away from me as she could. And she shouts at me, who in the hell are you? How do you know Edward Billy Meyer? Ah, the plot thickens, doesn't it? Well, it turns out that at that moment in my life, short of meeting Wendell Stevens or Lee Elders or perhaps Billy Meyer himself, probably this was the next best person I could have met and talked to, because this person had actually been there, knew Meyer well, had spent several weeks up there, had interviewed all the witnesses, had done the investigation, had done the measurements, had done everything that I was thinking I might want to do.
Hmm.
And so we ended up, she says, well, you know what, I finally tell her why, you know, I said, no, I said, I'm not military intelligence, because she said, are you military intelligence? And
yeah, because you think of government right away.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, she was scared. I mean, she was really scared. I mean, so anyway, I calmed her down. I told her, no, I'd read this book 3 months ago by Gary Kinder, and that I wanted to get to the bottom of Meyer case, that I was convinced. I mean, I had no doubt there were UFOs, but I just wanted to know if this was a real case, this particular one. And so then she calmed down. She says, you and I need to talk. Can you come back to my hotel while I check messages? And I did. I went back with her. And then we went down and sat down to some little open-air cafe bar place, and we sat there until the wee hours of the morning talking about UFOs and paranormal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as I said, it was just the greatest.
You have a very smart guide that told you exactly what to do, where to talk to. You know?
Absolutely true. Absolutely true.
I always tell people, listen to them. You know, they're trying to give you hints and things.
You got any idea who this person was, Dolores?
What?
You have any idea who it was?
Was probably your guide.
No, I mean this woman, who the woman was.
Oh, the woman was?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That had investigated the Meyer case and that...
Yeah. I don't think there's been very many women that have been associated.
No, there haven't. There haven't been. Anyway, it was Linda Moulton Howe.
Did you ever trace down about the film she was doing?
Well, it was Linda Moulton Howe.
With Linda?
Yeah, it was Linda.
I had her on the show just a few weeks ago.
Yep, that's how I met Linda.
We are really old friends. But you met her over there that long ago?
That long ago.
Oh, my gosh. It's a small world, isn't it?
It surely is.
We're all intertwined, really.
It is. Nothing happens by accident. I'm absolutely convinced of that anymore.
No, kind of entangled together, I guess, because we're all in the same field.
Exactly.
But what are the odds on that?
Yeah, exactly. What are the odds? What are the odds that you could go to the other side of the world, that you could go to an event, and that you could be told by a voice in your head that you had to talk to a woman that turns out to be the only woman that had investigated the Meyer case from the U.S. at least, and not only that, but one of the most knowledgeable women on the whole UFO paranormal stuff in general.
Oh, she is. She's very intelligent.
Yes. So, that goes off. It's off the chart. It's off the chart.
That's what we always say. You've got to listen to those little instincts, those inner feelings, and follow them.
So when I got back, I was saying, you know what? I make documentary films, but they're on aviation. What am I supposed to be doing with all this? I mean, this profoundly affected me, Dolores. Profoundly affected me. I never, ever had anything like that happen before. So when I got back, I was just constantly bothered. What am I going to do with this? Well, I figured, okay, I'm making documentary movies. I know how to do this. I'm probably supposed to make a documentary film on the UFO subject.
Yeah.
So I decided to do that. That took roughly the next year plus of my life, and we made UFOs a Need to Know. And very long story short, while doing that, I again began going to UFO conferences, quote-unquote, and I saw how horribly they were done. I saw that they were being done for the sole purpose of making their promoters money. And I saw that they basically all they would do for an inquiring person that wanted to come and learn, the way that they were done was basically they would each person that was there presenting would get a few minutes to give basically an almost free little presentation. But their whole job, their whole purpose was to try to convince you to go buy an extra workshop ticket to go hear the whole part of their story.
Oh,
so
like
when the public
teaser.
Would go there, they would end up with ulcers and a tight gut because they want to learn so much about this stuff and see and hear so many people. But the way these events were done, they were so disrespectful to the attendees and to the people presenting their material because you had to pick and choose.
Yeah, those are the teasers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've been to a lot of those. The whole life expos were an example of that.
Were an example of that.
Yeah, and I went to a lot of those back in those days where I spoke at them, and they told me that. They said, just do it as a teaser.
Right, because their purpose was to sell that workshop ticket. That was their purpose, sell that workshop ticket. So, you know what? I said, you know what? All these great people, I said, we need to put together an event that is done right. It is staged right, is produced right. It doesn't cost a person an arm and a leg. The purpose is not to rope them in there and then to prey on their interest to suck $20 bills out of them for workshop tickets, one after the other after the other. These events, these sort of events kind of went away. They kind of really went back, they really got very few and far between. About 7 years ago.
I don't want to go into it, but there was a lot of fraud involved with that.
Well,
the money and everything, the people who put them on.
Oh, of course, yeah, the people who put them on.
They were cheating people.
Of course they were. I mean, their purpose was to make money.
Came back on them eventually.
Now, the unfortunate thing is that these kinds of events are beginning to resurface. They're making a resurgency, and it's darned unfortunate. But our event remains true to its original goals. People will spend less money to spend a week with us to get the whole story from the best presenters in the world, professionally staged and presented. They'll spend less money to be with us for a week than they'll spend at the average two-day dog and pony show UFO event that's being put on today. Now, Lou's event, of course, is one of those that's never been done that way.
No, he does that on purpose.
Of course, and so do we. And, you know, his is a good, respectful event. And
I've helped with that since the very beginning.
Exactly. And the reason you did it, because it's being done for the right reasons.
Yeah. He doesn't charge very much. He said he doesn't care. I said, you know, you could raise your prices. But
yeah, well, that's what people say to us, particularly the people that put on these other sorts of events that are designed to make money. Why in the hell do you put that damn thing on so cheap? And you know what? We don't do it to make money.
That's what Lou said. He just, you know, lets it an affordable, people can get in, that if he covers his expenses, that's all he cares about.
Well, that's our goal. Our goal is to cover our expense and to maybe have enough left over so we can do it again the next year.
Yeah, that's what he said, the seed money to get ready for the next year.
That's right.
And, you know, I had my first conference this year in June, and I'm going to have a second one this June.
Wonderful.
And I had 100 people at the first one, which I don't think was bad.
Not for a first one.
Yeah, and our keynote speaker was the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi.
Wow.
So I'm getting some big names that are coming, and I know it's going to grow, but, you know, I've done this enough that I know how to put them on. It's not like beginning from scratch anyway.
Well, you betcha. You're right.
You have to have a background. People think it's easier than it is, but it really isn't. It's a lot of work goes into these things.
Yeah, until you've actually done it, you don't really have a clue.
Yeah, because some
really
people
don't.
Have told me, they say, well, I'm putting one on in a couple of months. And I said, a couple of months? You need at least a year
yeah.
to prepare.
Yeah, you needed to start a year ago.
And I know it's not going to be any good if it's only going to be a couple of months preparation on it anyway.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. But one thing I like about your show is that it's what I called it like Academy Awards night when you do review all of the UFO films that have been done during the year. And
yeah.
You give an award, and you know, you're up there in your tuxedo, and Carrie and your daughters were all dressed up in their evening gowns, and it was like the Academy Awards, is what I think.
Well, you know what it is? It's a lot of fun, and again,
it is.
You know, because I have been a documentary filmmaker, you know, I've made over 60 of those things, and there's very little recognition. Support. Certainly there's no money to be made in making documentary movies in general. And we feel that, you know, we just wanted to give the guys that are doing this work, that are making films like that, you know, some recognition.
But I liked it because it was done very professionally, and or the awards, and you have people seeing the different films all during the week, and then
yeah.
they vote on it.
Yeah, we have a judging panel, and Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday evening, all of those evenings are UFO films from 7 p.m. to midnight, UFO films, all the best ones from last year. And if you just come to attend the film festival, you're going to get a phenomenal education. Just with that.
You know who my guest is next week? I just talked to her this morning. It's Mary Rodwell.
Oh, Mary from Australia. Wonderful.
Yeah, and she won the award 1 year there.
Yeah, she did. That's right.
For the documentary that she made.
That's true. Yeah.
And she's making another one now. It's not quite finished yet.
Well, maybe we'll be screening that one next year.
Yes, maybe it'll be done by that time.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Yeah, she did a wonderful film.
Oh, see, and that's the thing, you know, when you're in this, you know all these people. And I've been to her house in Perth many, many times to speak to her group. So, you know, you get to know the real ones from the fakes anyway.
Yes, you do.
And there's a lot of fakes out there, too.
Amen.
But they don't last. Have you noticed that? They're like a flash in the pan. They may be there for a few years, making the circuit and doing the lectures, but then they don't stay because it's not real. There's nothing solid to it.
There's nothing solid to it, and then, of course, there's a handful that actually think there's money somehow
yeah.
in this. And when they figure out that there isn't.
That's what I always think. What are they doing up there? But they probably think they're going to make money, they'll get famous or whatever. But then I think the public catches on, too, and then they don't hear from them anymore.
Yeah.
They fade away.
Yep.
But, you know, we've been in this long enough to know that.
Well, listen, I want to tell you about a couple of things. You know, you've got our schedule, and, of course, anybody that's out there can go on our website,
Yeah, I'm going to have you give all that information before we sign off today anyway.
and get all the details on who's speaking. But I want to tell you specifically about a couple people because we had a couple of to-be-announced slots when the actual brochure went out, the 8-page brochure.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you about a couple of these things. One of our presenters in one of those spots is going to be Ralph Ring. Now, Ralph Ring is a young man in his 70s now, and actually Ralph was part of a team, an original team that actually engineered a electrogravitic craft back in the 50s and 60s, actually built it and flew it. And this particular incident, this particular team and their resultant craft had been known about, but the thing that people didn't know about until just recently was that one of the team members was still alive, one of the engineers was still alive.
Oh, they thought by now they'd all died.
Yes, they thought they had all died, and it was one of these stories that was basically, shall we say, sort of UFO legend.
Yeah.
In that it was a story that was well reported on and well documented, but all of the players, all the people that reported and talked on it, had all passed on. So it remained sort of, you know, one of those areas. But believe it or not,
you said you have another one too. That's going to be it wasn't in the program.
Yeah, Dr. Richard Sauter is going to come and make another presentation for us. And he is going to talk to us, well, primarily, and he's going to talk about more than just this, but his primary talk is going to be on the Secret Astronaut Corps, the military Secret Astronaut Corps, and the fact that that corps began, shut down in the 80s officially, and it actually began virtually almost a decade ahead of NASA. So the implications of that are rather staggering.
Well, and also, I want to tell people that I'm going to be there next week also.
Well, of course you are.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, Bob, you know, in the years before, I've tried to keep my talks where I think is in the limit of what the people can understand. I'm always worried about going over their heads, because I'm getting more and more information that is very profound. And I always worry about that, you know, telling them too much or you know, scrambling their brains. Well, this time I'm getting so much information that's going to be going in the Convoluted Universe Book 3. I think I'm going to just take a chance and tell them what I've got and see if it blows them away.
Oh, Dolores, I'm so looking forward to that. I'm so happy to hear that.
You don't think I will shake them up too much, then?
No, I don't. You know, look, and I don't mean this for anybody that may be listening and that may think that this is going to be, you know, over their heads. It really isn't. But the people that come to our event, we have a lot of first-time people. We always have huge numbers of brand-new people that find out about it for the first time and attend. However, we also have a great number of people that reattend. We have a core group that have probably been to virtually everyone from the first one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's only a handful of people, of course.
Yeah.
But there is that core group. So we have a great number that return. And so many of the people that come to our event, they're not people that are just beginners, that are just beginning to look into these subjects. So many of the people that come to our event are the thinkers that have gone a long way.
Okay, and, because, you know, I look at the crowd, you can usually read the audience, and if they don't understand, you see their eyes glaze over.
No. We'll be ready.
And there's others that'll tell me, oh, no, I want to know more. Why don't you tell us the rest?
We'll be ready for you, Dolores.
Okay, I'm going to tell them when I start out. I don't know if this is going to blow your mind or not, you know, but I think it's time because I'm getting very powerful information.
Wonderful. I'm excited.
You know, before it gets too late, I do want to bring up, you remember the experience we had was around 9/11. You remember that?
Oh, boy, do I ever. Wasn't that some week?
Yeah.
What a powerful week that was. Oh, my.
Didn't know what was going to happen. with the conference or anything.
No, no, you're right.
I was, you know, I told them before, because I've had PMH Atwater on here, and we were together. We got stuck in North Carolina right after we had had a conference on 9/11. And the only way I could get back, we had a rental car, and I drove it all the way back. And I just got back, and you called, and you said, we're going to start out driving. And they said, you've got to be there, even if you're going to have to drive. And I just drove 2 days to get home. But, you know, a lot of your speakers that were almost planes, they were turning them around in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah, right. We had speakers coming from England that literally got turned around. You're right. But, you know,
it was and you said, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, well.
They thought you should call it off, but, you know, you said, no, I'm going to do it. You probably lose money, but you'd lose more if you didn't put it on.
You're right. At that point, once you get that far, you know, when you're you're a week out from doing the conference, less than that, I think 5 days it was, I think.
Yeah.
out from doing the conference, you're pretty going to be committed. You're going to lose your shirt whether you put it on or don't put it on at that point. So we put it on, and our attendance was down like about 50%.
Yeah.
But the people that were there, that was the greatest summer conference we ever had. That was beyond magical, that event, because every speaker was this whole 9/11 experience. It shadowed and it shaped everybody's presentation.
I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I got on the first plane. They began flying the planes that week, the Saturday before, and I got on the first plane going to Las Vegas.
Do you know every speaker but one got there?
Hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
And, you know, people kept telling, and I felt the same way, that if we hadn't have been doing that, we'd been sitting home, glued to the TV set, and they were replaying this over and over and over again.
Yep. Yep.
That way we were there, we were able to get our minds off of it and go into something else.
Indeed.
It was very important that I commend you for going ahead with it.
Yeah, it was important. And the people that did come, you know, the delegates that did get there for that one, it was probably the most meaningful conference they've ever had.
Did my talk. You said change your talk and talk about the Nostradamus prophecies. And it was very difficult, that talk, because I said I never thought I'd have to give a talk like that.
I remember.
And I think everybody felt something.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we've been through some things anyway.
We have, Dolores. We really have. I want to tell your listeners about one more really amazing thing.
Okay,
you know, Maurice.
I'm watching the clock because I got to stop at 5:00, and I want you to give your information out to
me. Oh, okay.
So
all right.
There.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to let everybody know that Maurice Cotterell, from England, is coming over again for us. Now, Maurice is the greatest sun scientist in the world, and using his discoveries about the sun, our sun,
yeah,
he went on to crack the code of the Mayas, Lida Palenque, went on to crack the Tutankhamun codes in Egypt and the Viracocha South American codes, and finally he cracked the codes of the Terracotta warriors in China.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's the greatest archaeologist in the world and the greatest sun scientist. And he's done it by combining the two. Now, this great man told us literally less than a week ago, Bob, by the way, I have figured out gravity.
Gravity.
Now, coming from anybody else, I would still be interested, of course, but coming from Maurice, I'm so excited I could spit. Maurice is going to tell us the truth about gravity. And once we understand what gravity is and how it works, we'll then know how to manipulate it. This is going to be explained to the world.
I don't think I'm going to feel so strange on some of the things I'm going to be talking about.
I know that you will not. I know that you will not.
Well, before we sign off, give everybody your information, how they can find out more about the conference.
All right. Well, those that have internet, probably the best way to do it is to go just to the Congress's website, which is simple. It's ufocongress.com. That's
the easiest way, rather than calling you, isn't it?
Well, it really is, because they're going to get pages and pages of info about the event, about transportation, about registration. And people can come for as little as one session, or they can come for the whole 7-night program.
I think once they get there, they get bitten, you know, and they want to know more.
Exactly, exactly. Now, if they do want to call us, and they do want to talk to a human being, we're very happy to talk with anyone that needs info. And our number, phone number, is 303-651-7137. And our last day to take reservations that include rooming at the host hotel is on February 20th. And we got to do that by, I think it's 2 or 3 p.m. Mountain Time, February 20th. That's the last time we can take registrations which include your hotel room. After that point, if people want to come, of course, we can always give them the conference stuff, but they have to deal directly with the hotel after the 20th for rooming. And
this is going to be at the Aquarius Resort.
Yes, at the Aquarius, which is the former Flamingo Hilton. It's this year it is taken over by new ownership, and this year it is the Aquarius. And they're doing a lot of remodeling, too. It's you're going to see a lot of changes, really neat changes when you get there.
All right. Well, I think I'm coming up to the time I got to quit because Don will pull the plug otherwise. But I really want to thank you, Bob, for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Dolores. It's been awesome.
I think you're going to have a really good attendance again.
Well, we will, yes. We're looking right now at about, based on numbers at the moment, it looks like we're going to be right around that 800 mark again.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, we always hope that a lot of people are going to make the last-minute life-changing decision to come and attend this event.
And they do. They make it the last minute.
They do. And I promise you, if you come, it'll be the week of your life. And it is not expensive, folks. It isn't.
It really isn't, because even the hotel, the restaurants, they keep their prices down. It's not at all like Las Vegas.
No, it isn't.
Like Las Vegas used to be.
It's like Las Vegas was 30 years ago, honestly.
When everything was affordable.
Exactly, when everything was affordable.
Okay.
And, you know, the whole package for full attendance and room and everything is, like, still under, like, $60 a day on a double. I mean, it's
that
unbelievable.
That includes the room.
Yeah, oh, yeah, room included.
Well, we're going to have to go, but I really do appreciate you coming on, and I'll be seeing you next week anyway.
Dolores, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, and I know you're going to have a good show.
We will.
All right. All right, now good night, everybody.
Good night.